Just before I begin the sermon proper, I did miss one announcement. A couple of you have asked if I would give it. I'm going to be giving a presentation on Anglican prayer, or prayer according to the great tradition, tonight at Nexus Fellowship at 5:30, followed by a Q&A afterwards. They've been exploring the topic of, is there an interventionist God that answers our prayers? And how does that happen? And so I'm going to be speaking in a broader frame of reference from the great tradition on prayer and what it is, actually, I think, from my perspective. So if you're interested in coming, the service starts at 5:30. It's okay to admit that we struggle with different parts of the Bible. Perhaps you were gulping somewhat during that gospel reading. Indeed, I think it helps us often if we're willing to engage our thinking, to go deeper. I know, for instance, many Christians who struggle with a perception that the God of the First or the Old Testament is angry, vengeful, and nasty, but who feel that the God presented to us in the New Testament is one of love. And, I mean, I don't know if they've ever read texts like we read today, but this was such a strong perception for me that it shaped my studies in seminary. I wanted to discover the truth of the matter, and I was greatly helped by studying Jewish scholars and discovering that they don't recognize, that though they don't recognize the New Testament as inspired scripture, their understanding of God is not one of a vengeful tyrant, but of a God who is characterized chiefly by loving faithfulness. Ironically, I've also met some people who've given up on the Hebrew scriptures, who tell me they get their message from the New Testament, and yet the God they project seems quite nasty and vengeful, to me at least, quite exclusionary of Jews and of many others. Go figure. It seems that interpretation is as much about character formation, what we bring to the reading of the text in the first place, as it does about the words on the page, or as it does have to do with the words on the page. Now, having said that, I have and still do struggle with not so much the message of the gospel, which I'll explain in a minute, but with the message of the book of Esther. Maybe that's because in the climax of the book, which we read today, there is a kind of, rough justice, maybe. There's definitely a feeling that the vengeance is there. There's a blatant feeling to the book, and it's tinged with Freudenschade. Do you know that word? That's a German word which means pleasure derived from others' misfortune, and it makes me feel uncomfortable. And I mean to say by that I feel it. I'm very happy that Haman meets his demise in the way that he does. And that leaves me feeling uncomfortable. The Jewish feast, the Feast of Purim, something the worldwide Jewish community celebrates near the beginning of March each year, the Jewish month of Adar, and in celebration of this event, is filled with uncomfortable replications of the moment we just read. At the moment of Haman's death, well, actually, every time Haman's voice or name is read in the story, you're supposed to make a large racket so that nobody hears his name. But at the moment of Haman's death, children are tasked to blow trumpets in celebration and bang on drums. Now, I understand that it's done in the spirit of Psalm 124. which we just recited together, the renewed safety of the community after the defeat of enemies. I also understand that Haman had asked for it. He had plotted a widespread pogrom, a destruction of the Jewish people, something that has repeated itself time and again in history. Probably the Assyrians and Hitler being the two that have come the closest to actually annihilating the Jews. Now, I'm wondering if I've not too easily bought into a philosophy that says, if I'm simply nice to people, if I help my neighbors and try to live well, the world will be a better place. Well, yes, but as some of our finest theologians are now saying, we need to be reminded that being nice, even seeking reconciliation at a great cost, good as those things are, has to be balanced by a willingness to name and resist evil. As Kevin Dixon said last week, talking about some of the work of the International Justice Mission, peace and justice doesn't just float down out of the ether. Christians have to be willing to work together with people of goodwill all over the world and actually bring perpetrators to justice. You know, as Jesus said in the text today, just because somebody doesn't officially follow him doesn't mean that what they're doing for the sake of justice is opposed to Jesus. This is hard and difficult work in which we are forced to look at our own feelings, the discomfort we feel when dealing with evil and sin in ourselves and in those who perpetuate wide-scale abuse in our world. In a theme that unites rather than divides the two testaments in our Bible, we have in our readings today the image of perpetrators of evil facing judgment. Indeed, the anger of God. Here in Esther, the wrath of God is exercised through the Persian king, the monarch. In Mark 9, even as we have Jesus taking little ones into his arms, even as we have the final words of be at peace with one another, we also have these horrible words. Words about millstones around the neck, unquenchable fire and self-mutilation. In James, where healing, forgiveness, and restoration are front and central, we're reminded of Elijah. And if we dare look back at that story referenced, if we look back at where that story is referenced, or where James takes Elijah's name from, we find at its center the falling of fire and the destructions of the prophets of Baal. And so there's no way around the conclusion that, biblically speaking, God is committed to act against people who persist in wickedness, and that action is done in concert with people who are working alongside God's call that justice and peace be offered to all, particularly to those who are abused, who are weak, and are unable to stand up for themselves. Well, what does this mean for us? What does it mean for Christians who follow a crucified Messiah, the one we believe who embodies God's character and very being in a way that no one else has? Who himself submitted to illegitimate justice, the arrogant justice of Rome, the mob, and the religious authorities, who didn't fight back or use violence himself. What does it mean for us then to bring perpetrators to justice? Each of these texts, I think, offers us something. Now, I persist in my belief that there are things in Esther that we should remain very uncomfortable with. Maybe this scene, but certainly what happens next. Because we discover that in light of Haman's death, groups of Jews end up doing a lot of slaughtering of their enemies. Vengeance gives way to increased violence, not peace. So there's that. But positively, we note that Mordecai urged Esther to witness to the truth of Haman's intentions. Exposing evil is something all of us are called to do and can do as we're made aware of it, as it comes across our path. When I was in my first year as an Anglican priest, I was made aware by a parishioner that an Anglican chaplain at the local hospital had several times inappropriately touched and fondled her. It was an awful situation. I felt like Esther. I knew what I needed to do, but I was scared. I needed to do the right thing and not mess it up. I wondered why this burden had come to me as a first-year priest. And I didn't want to overreact or underreact. See, I've always been suspicious of those who are on witch hunts, who go out looking for trouble, who are on a righteous crusade, if you will, who seem to know almost instantaneously what the right thing to do is. I didn't know if I should go straight to the police or pass it on to the bishop. I did the latter, and the bishop went to the police. He acted quickly and justly on the woman's behalf. But some of the priests, including some of the senior priests in the diocese, were very angry with me. They thought we should have dealt with it in-house. You heard that one before, right? In fact, that's what is troubling the largest church in the world right now: mishandling of sexual abuse crises. I had supposedly ruined a priest's career. The offending priest had actually ruined his own career. I didn't think what I did was heroic or special, and it wasn't. I just stood up for someone who was defenseless, something that happens all the time in this town and around the world. And indeed, there are many of you that have done it far more than me. You have stood up for the defenseless and the weak in this congregation and in our wider community, and you have given them opportunities they wouldn't be able to obtain by themselves. You've treated them as human beings deserving of respect and rights. And when you do those things, you do no less than I did. You do no less than Esther did, or what Jesus asks from each of us. As has been famously said by John F. Kennedy and many others, all that is required for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing. If we turn to James, it's no exaggeration to say that the last verse of this letter provides a backdrop for all we do here at St. Matthew. You should know, James says, that whoever brings back a sinner from wandering will save the sinner's soul from death and will cover a multitude of sins. It reminds me of the great line from the Jewish Talmud: whoever saves a life is someone who has saved the entire world. We're in the world-saving business. And we follow a Messiah who has claimed to do just such a thing. We're all potential heroes, servants. But the vast difference that marks us from the Hollywood portrayals is that we're called to do it one small witness to the truth, one small kindness, one small open gesture of acceptance and love at a time. And I think this is the power of what Pope Francis is trying to teach us at this moment in history. He's reminding us that, like Jesus, taking the little ones into his arms, we're called not to serve ideologies. We're not to put ideas front and central, capitalism or socialism, not right-wing values or left-wing values, but people. People. The world itself, its environment, and its inhabitants. Of course, in concert with the text before us today, he's reminding us, Pope Francis is, that the true enemies are not political enemies, but those who are destroying human lives, those who are destroying our planet for the sake of greed and expediency. For as the Talmud also says, whoever destroys a human life is like someone who destroys an entire world. So as we seek to dialogue about what it means to both positively do what we can to aid people in their cause of justice and resist evildoers, we will need to follow Jesus, the crucified and risen Savior who gives God's very Spirit for precisely this mission in this time. And the good news is that you and I have experienced this rescue, this grace of having our souls saved from death. And in turn, we are called into the extraordinary dignity of helping witness to the truth. We are called to aid the little ones and to expose injustice. We're invited and called into Christ's mission, which is never an idea, but the person standing right in front of us.